Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the life and crimes of the dating game killer Rodney Acala. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just look for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. You can find me on most social media networks underneath any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, along with exclusive content such as the series covering the many allegations that have been made against Vince McMahon over the years, the Columbine Massacre, and the Atlanta Child Murders, which I have just dropped the 8th episode of yesterday at the time you are hearing this. Just as my friends Channel and Anthony have done, Debbie, Samantha, Mark, and a slew of others who I am extremely grateful for. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last time, Rodney Acala had just left New York to travel back to California after having murdered Ellen Hoover and leaving her body on the Rockefeller estate in a shallow grave and covered in rocks. He ends up getting an apartment in Monterey Villa, East Los Angeles, as well as a job working as a typesetter for the LA Times. We know that he ends up purchasing a Datsun F10 station wagon, and that it's with this vehicle that he is going to continue his murderous rampage. We know that during this period of time, Acala started using his camera ruse again, claiming to be a fashion photographer. But unlike his past escapades, Acala did not keep his photography to just young girls and women. In fact, eventually when police find his various stashes of photographs, they notice that there are many young men as well as boys who he photographed. Some have speculated that this could be because Acala was killing indiscriminately, while others theorize that it was a means to further his ruse to be able to show people, look, I don't just take, you know, pictures of women. But it's also possible that he was, in fact, looking to work as a photographer and did indeed intend to build a portfolio with which to get job assignments or clients. Now, his next known victim was an 18-year-old by the name of Jill Barkham, who encountered Acala while she was working at a coffee shop in the Hollywood Hills section of Los Angeles. This was on November 9th of 1977. We know that Acala encountered her near the end of her shift. As to what the exact nature of their conversation, it's fairly well established that Acala would introduce himself as a fashion photographer and ask the young woman whether or not they wanted to be photographed. And Acala usually was able to get these women to concede to his wishes. a lot of people have made an issue of the fact that Jill Barkham ends up being taken to a piece of property adjacent to Marlon Brando's compound. Should also be noted that Jack Nicholson lived on the other side of Marlon Brando. In any event, Jill is driven to this area off of Mulholland Drive. There is some speculation as to whether or not Alcala attempted to initiate consensual sex with Jill. What we do know with certainty is that he smashed her face in with a rock and that he raped her before strangling Jill with the navy blue slacks that she had been wearing. And afterwards, Alcala would take photographs of Jill's body, posing her in different positions as he clicked away with his camera. This is one of those aspects of Alcala's crimes that people are often aware of. They know that he posed as a photographer, that he took thousands of pictures of naked women and girls, but they're unaware of the fact that he would take photographs of the young women during the course of his assaults, both as he was raping them, while he was murdering them, as well as afterwards. Afterwards, Alcala posed Jill. Some reports state her hands had been tied behind her back. However, not every report contains this detail. What we do know for certain is that he had pressed her knees to her chest so that when people came upon her, she was lying on her side with the knees against the chest and her head lying upon the ground. Investigators later learned that Alcala had taken both the earrings as well as the panties that Jill had been wearing. There were numerous scratches and abrasions upon her arms and legs, as well as bite marks upon her breasts. Jill's body was discovered the next day, and due to the nature of the assault and how vicious it was, investigators initially suspected that the Hillside Stranglers, who were also active in California during this period of time, were responsible for Jill's murder. A small side note, Jill, who had moved to Los Angeles roughly 1 month prior to meeting Rodney Alcala, had very few friends in the area. However, one of her friends was a 15-year-old by the name of Judy Miller, and about a week and a half prior to Jill's murder, Judy had in fact become the second known victim of the Hillside Stranglers. Alcala's movements over the next few weeks are very hard to pinpoint. We know he went to work. We also know that he continued to take photographs when the opportunity arose. This is part of what led to speculation concerning whether or not he has other victims that we're unaware of. As we've discussed many times before, serial killers often go through a cooling off period after committing a murder. And at least with the information that we currently have, Alcala seems to have been no different from other killers in this regard. After he kills Jill Barkham, he appears to have cooled off. The need, the obsession to kill has subsided for the time being, although he is still taking these photographs. We also know that he is showing some of these photographs to co-workers at the Los Angeles Times, with a few of these co-workers coming forward and saying that while they thought it was rather odd that he would show this side of himself to people at work, they really didn't think it was anything nefarious or that needed to be reported to authorities or to management. His next known victim is 27-year-old nurse Georgia Marie Wixted. And this occurs on December 16th, 1977. We know that on that night, Georgia was out with a friend of hers by the name of Barbara Gale. Some sources state that they were at a nightclub, others that they were at a bar when they met Alcala. Regardless of which one it was, he introduced himself as a photographer, which both women found interesting, although they both eventually left, and it's surmised that Alcala followed them out of this establishment, having zeroed in on Georgia, whom he found attractive, and followed them as Georgia dropped Barbara off at her apartment before heading to her own domicile in Malibu. We know that Alcala ended up going to the back of Georgia's apartment and removing the screen from one of the windows that led inside, using a wooden crate that was nearby in order to step up into the windowsill. He forces the latch on the window, entering through the kitchenette, after which he made his way to the bedroom where Georgia, sleeping in the nude, was unaware of his presence. As he did with the majority of his victims, Alcala proceeded to strangle Georgia into unconsciousness before reviving her, and we discussed this in the last episode. He would do this repeatedly to a victim. In the case of Georgia, we know that this was done from what the pathologist's report stated. He sexually assaulted her at least once, all the while taking photographs of her. At some point during all of this, a hammer came into play. Now, the hammer belonged to Georgia. He used it to bludgeon her before strangling Georgia to death with her pantyhose. We know that Alcala wiped down the apartment to some degree, leaving Georgia's body lying on the floor in her bedroom. We also know that he took a pair of earrings from the apartment that belonged to her before leaving the apartment through the rear door. It's been speculated that after leaving Georgia's apartment, Alcala drove back to his own apartment, and along the way he got rid of his shirt as well as a dish rag that he had used to wipe down her apartment in the Pacific Ocean. So the following morning, December 16th, 1977, Georgia was supposed to pick her friend up, Barbara Gale, because they were both working a shift at the hospital. Barbara waited for her friend to arrive, and when she did not, she began placing phone calls to Georgia's apartment, which went unanswered. And eventually, Barbara goes to work in her own vehicle, and still unable to reach Georgia, she contacts the Malibu Police Department, who go to the apartment that Georgia lived in. Very quickly, it's surmised that a fairly horrific sexual assault and murder has taken place. Georgia's body is found lying on a throw rug in her bedroom beside her bed, and it appeared to officers as though she had been posed. The hammer that had been used to bludgeon her was lying between her legs with the handle part aimed towards her vaginal area, which had been severely mutilated. And this is a new move for Alcala, this mutilation of the sexual organs. Before, we have seen biting of the breasts, now he's actually moving into, you know, destroying the victim's sex organs. The bedroom was covered in blood spray from the assault. Later, it would be determined that Georgia had a broken neck as well as numerous skull fractures, and her cause of death was listed as asphyxiation along with blunt force trauma to the brain. Now, investigators were able to get a partial palm print from the railing on the brass bed in Georgia's bedroom, as well as DNA. However, at the time, none of this really meant anything. They couldn't match either of these things to any suspect. So as with the other victims that Alcala has already taken, Georgia's case ends up going cold. Once again, Alcala seems to have gone into a cooling off phase. However, as with all of his crimes, it's difficult to know whether or not this is in fact the case, because even though there are no murders attributed to him for the next 6 months, he continues with his photography. And even if he did not kill anyone else during this period of time, which I find highly dubious, there is the possibility that Alcala committed rapes during this period of time. But again, we don't know for certain, as rape statistics are notoriously difficult to track. And then, as is now, a victim of rape is reticent to come forward and inform authorities that they have in fact been sexually assaulted. This is unfortunate, but during this period of time, and even today a little, there was a prevailing line of thought that these women had been asking for it, and it was felt that they would not be believed when they contacted authorities, so many women simply did not go to the authorities and inform them that they had been assaulted. It is possible that, you know, Alcala, as with many other serial killers, might have been captured before he was able to take more lives, had law enforcement and society as a whole looked differently at sexual assault and believed these women's accounts. So Rodney Acala's next known victim was Charlotte Lee Lamb, aged 31, who worked as a legal secretary on June 24th, 1978. Lamb had arranged for a cocktail party at the Manhattan Beach Pier, where the law firm that she worked for was celebrating having signed a very big client. Now, it's speculated that Alcala, who was seen during the day taking photographs of young women and girls, came upon this party and learned about Charlotte from the caterers. It's known that he approached her at some point during the party, claiming to be a photographer and telling her that he was doing a photo spread for a magazine. He convinces her to let Rodney photograph her, and they end up on the beach where darkness is setting in. It's speculated that Alcala bludgeoned Charlotte Lamb in the head with a piece of driftwood he had found on the beach, at which point he rapes Charlotte before taking her life. Alcala ends up dropping Charlotte's body off at the apartment complex that she lived in El Segundo. On the morning of June 24th, one of the residents of this apartment complex goes into the laundry room and finds Charlotte's nude body lying on the floor. they contact police, who arrive on the scene to find Charlotte lying face up with her legs spread wide so that anyone entering the laundry room would immediately be able to see her most private of parts. Charlotte's hands were tucked behind her back. The shoes that Charlotte had been wearing, a pair of wedge-shaped sandals that had shoelaces on them, had been used to strangle Charlotte, and the laces, along with one of the shoes, was still cinched tightly around her throat. In the investigative report, it's noted that while Charlotte's ears were pierced, there were no earrings present at the time that her body was discovered. Later, it's going to be found that a pair of earrings in possession of Rodney Acala belonged to Charlotte Lamb. As with the previous victim, there was a good amount of genital mutilation present, along with various cuts and bruises to the breast area. Over the course of the weekend, friends and family continuously attempted to contact Charlotte, as her birthday was on June 26th. Eventually, Charlotte's sister contacts the Santa Monica police and informs them that they cannot get a hold of her, and police go to Charlotte's apartment, which is found to be deserted. And this should give you some idea as to the nature of police departments during this period of time. You have the Santa Monica Police Department and the El Segundo Police Department. The El Segundo Police Department is the department that actually found Charlotte's body, while the Santa Monica Police Department is the department that went to investigate her apartment. Neither of them knew what the other was up to. The El Segundo Department had not put anything out on the teletype stating that a white woman had been found murdered inside of the apartment complex laundry room. Therefore, the Santa Monica police had no idea that Charlotte's body had been discovered. However, they eventually do make contact in some capacity and realize that the young woman who had been found inside of the laundry room was in fact Charlotte Lamb. As with all of the other crimes Acala had committed up to this point in California, authorities had no suspects, so they began to look at Charlotte's murder as a possible victim of the as-yet unidentified Hillside Stranglers. After committing this murder, Acala continues on taking photographs, and what happens next in his life is one of the most talked about things that he ever did outside of murder, and is in fact how he got his moniker as the dating game killer. Now, for those too young to remember the dating game, it was fairly simple. You would have a young woman called the Bachelorette, who would be sitting on a stool or in a chair next to the host with a divider next to her. Behind the divider, there would be three contestants, the bachelors, and the Bachelorette would ask the bachelors questions in order to determine which one was the most suitable for her to go out on a date with. At this point in time, the show was hosted by Jim Lang. And according to Lang, when Acala arrived on September 13th of 1978 to participate on the show, he asked him when the episode was going to air. And Acala was somewhat distraught to learn that it would be almost an entire year before this particular episode would be shown to a national viewing audience. I'm gonna play some parts from Alcala's appearance on the episode so you can hear his voice as well as the answers that he gave as Alcala ends up winning the date with the Bachelorette Cheryl.
Time to meet our first three eligible bachelors for game number one, and here they are. Good luck, gentlemen. Well, let's see. Bachelor number one is a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the dark room at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, he might find him skydiving or motorcycling. Please welcome Rodney Alcala. Rod, welcome. Next, we welcome... Okay, and we're going to start by having him say hello to you and see how they sound. Number one, would you say hello to Cheryl, please? We're going to have a great time together, Cheryl. Okay.
Bachelor number one.
Yes?
What's your best time?
The best time is at night, nighttime.
Why do you say that?
Because that's the only time there is.
The only time? What's wrong with morning, afternoon?
Well, they're okay, but nighttime's when it really gets good. Then you're really ready.
How about you, Batch? I'm a drama teacher, and I'm going to audition each of you for my private class. Bachelor number one.
You're a dirty old man.
Take it.
Oh, come on, over here.
Oh, honey, we gotta go out and
a bachelor number one, I am serving you for dinner.
Oh.
What are you called, and what do you look like?
I'm called the banana, and I look really good.
Can you be a little more descriptive?
Peel me.
Welcome back to the dating game, and Cheryl, we have reached the moment of truth, as we call it. You've heard from the bachelors, you got some great dramatic presentations, some good answers, but now I'm going to ask you a question. Will that date be bachelor number one, bachelor number two, or bachelor number three? Who gets the dates?
Well, I like bananas, so I'll take one.
Number one! Any more questions about that? I'll just tell you something about the other bachelors. You didn't choose number two, who did a fine acting job as a virgin maiden. He's an actor, a skin diver from New York City. Say hi to Jed Mills. Jed, come on in this show. Shucks. You didn't choose number three either, and he is into music and soccer. You can get over here, Jed, so the other guy can get in. Attaboy. And here he is, Armand Chiami. All right, Armand. Gentlemen, you missed out on the date. We're sorry about that. We do have some gifts for you, though, and you played a great game. Really super. Thanks so much. Okay, come back and see you again. Thank you. There they go. However, you did leave one remaining, and this is your date, and I want to tell you something about him, Cheryl. He's a skydiver, so he's got a lot of nerve. He's into motorcycling. He's also a fine photographer. Say hello to Rodney Alcala. Rodney, come on and say hello. Some sort of racket, so we're going to have you take to the court. First, you'll receive tennis lessons from expert Naomi Besa of the famous Kirkwood Tennis Club. That starts, and you'll soon be acing everyone off the court. And to make sure you both look as professional as you'll become, complete tennis outfits will be provided by Bill Darling's Tennis Shop. It'll really make you look like part of the racket set. Then it's off to Magic Mountain, one of America's greatest and most complete amusement parks, with plenty of excitement to challenge any daring dater, like the Revolution, that'll help you turn the town upside down, and of course the world's greatest roller coaster, the Colossus. Magic Mountain, just a half an hour north of Hollywood, California. So have first find out what runners-up will receive today from Johnny Jacobs. John?
So there you heard it. The entirety of Rodney Alcala's appearance on the dating game. Now, the other contestants would later state that Alcala was off-putting and extremely strange, while the woman... Now, the date never ends up happening. Once they were backstage and sequestered in a room where the two of them could talk and get to learn each other a little bit better, Cheryl found Alcala to be creepy. She later stated that he continuously requested that he allow him to photograph her, while also making suggestions about her manner of dress and stating that she should undo some of the buttons on her shirt to show a little bit more cleavage. It's been speculated that this rejection by Cheryl further fueled Alcala's desire to exert his control over women. However, it would be a number of months before Alcala is known to have struck again. We know that he continues to take photographs of young girls and young women as well as men, although we don't have any evidence to conclusively link to any crimes that he might have committed. Remember, this is California, late 1970s. There's a lot of missing persons cases cropping up and numerous women being found murdered. This is also complicated by the fact that Alcala was smart enough to travel out of state up in Oregon and Seattle, where he kept a locker filled with the various pictures and mementos that he had taken from his victims. In January of 1979, the Hillside Stranglers were identified and arrested as being Angelo Bruno and his cousin, Kenneth Bianchi. And the two men were very quick to admit to the crimes that they had committed. However, when presented with the victims that Alcala had murdered, both of them ardently refused to take credit, stating basically that it wasn't their crimes and that they had not committed these murders. And this was information that was released by the news media. And from all accounts, Rodney Alcala learned of this and began to feel nervous, suspecting that it may not be long before authorities were on to him. However, this was counterbalanced by the fact that Alcala had a fairly large ego, as most serial killers do, and had become so proficient at his ruse and his killing that he began to feel like he was invincible and would not ever be caught by authorities. It was also around this time that, at least according to Alcala, he began experiencing night terrors. He stated that it was really the images of the young women that he had murdered in New York that terrorized him, saying that in this dream he was on a airline flight, and always this plane was in the process of crashing, and usually Cornelia Criley would begin chastising him, telling him that the plane that they're on won't crash if he gives her her life back. And invariably, the other women whose lives Alcala had taken would begin to one by one approach him and say similar things. However, it's unknown whether this night terror, which he stated happened almost every Sunday until the year 1986, actually took place or if it was a way that Alcala was trying to design a possible insanity defense should he ever be captured and put on trial. It's important to note at this point that Alcala had begun freelancing as a photographer, taking photographs for various magazines, and on February 13th, he was out in the San Gabriel Mountains taking scenic photographs that had been pre-purchased by the LA Times for an article they were planning on doing covering the Eaton Canyon Falls. After this, as Alcala made his way home, he found himself in Pasadena, and near an area called Lacey Park, he saw a young woman hitchhiking on the side of the road. Alcala pulls over and offers her a ride, learning fairly quickly that she is a 15-year-old by the name of Monique Hoyt. Alcala is able to convince Monique to return to his apartment, where, according to Monique, he asked her if she had any spare clothes with her, learning that she had only brought a pair of underwear and jeans with her. Alcala gets her a shirt as well as a bath towel, offering Monique the use of his shower. They end up watching a movie together, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, as well as eating popcorn and drinking root beer. Should be noted that Alcala avoided alcohol consumption. And at some point during the course of watching this movie, Alcala begins to touch Monique. She consents to this, and eventually they end up having consensual sex, although some reports state that Alcala in fact raped the young girl. Most of the statements that I could find from her stated that this was in fact a consensual act, and that she found herself very attracted to Alcala. Afterwards, again according to Monique, the two of them shared a joint, and Alcala nonchalantly asked Monique whether or not she had ever had anal sex. She responds telling him that, quote-unquote, that's dirty, why do you have to ruin such a good moment? After which, the two of them go to sleep. Monique stated that she awoke the next morning to find that Alcala had made both of them breakfast. And as they ate, the two of them discussed Monique posing for a photo shoot with Alcala. He had been plying her the previous day, telling her that she was very beautiful and could very possibly be a model, which obviously flattered Monique. She was completely sold on the deal when Alcala offered her $1,000 for the photo shoot. When he suggested during breakfast that they should do the photo shoot in nature, Monique said that she knew the perfect area for them to go to. The two of them drove roughly 75 miles east of Los Angeles to an isolated grassy field that Monique informed Alcala she had visited many times in the past with her friends when they would go to sunbathe there nude. The area was located on Eagle Mountain in Riverside County, not far from the Joshua Tree National Park. Monique had grown up in the area and had suggested it as she truly believed that Alcala was a decent individual. Alcala was able to get Monique to pose both clothed as well as in the nude. According to Monique, the photo shoot was going well. She was having fun. standing there topless when Alcala demanded that she remove both her shorts as well as her underwear. Monique later stated that at this point, Alcala's demeanor changed completely, as though someone had flipped a switch inside of him, and he became cold, any shreds of warmth vanishing from his personality. She further stated that as he continued the photo session, he began chastising her for refusing his suggesting that they try anal sex. At some point during this, Alcala ordered Monique to have simulated sex with a tree branch so that he could photograph it. Monique refuses this request. When Alcala approached Monique and began chastising her, calling her a crybaby, she attempted to run. Alcala is very quickly able to overpower the 15-year-old, and he ends up shoving tank top into her mouth before binding her arms behind her back with his belt and then choking her unconscious, after which Alcala sexually assaults Monique, including sodomizing her. Monique stated that she came to at some point after noon with the shirt removed from her mouth, but the belt still tying her hands tightly behind her back. She stated that Alcala was sitting a few feet away from her with his back turned towards her, talking to himself, and that on occasion she could understand phrases that he was mumbling. These were not planned, incoherent, and gotten out of hand. Monique stated that she realized at this point that the only way she was going to survive this assault was if she pretended as though she had enjoyed what Alcala did and played nice with him. So she began talking to Alcala, kindly asking him to untie her, telling him that she was sorry that she had rejected him the previous night, asking him if they could start again as it was Valentine's Day. Alcala ends up releasing Monique. They get dressed and begin their drive back to his apartment, where, according to Monique, she says that Alcala apologized for attacking her, blaming it on what he said was antisocial personality disorder, something that he had been diagnosed with in the United States Army. Some sources state that Alcala bashed Monique in the head with a rock during his assault, and that he sexually assaulted her multiple times. The information I just gave you there comes directly from Monique's statements to law enforcement, and as you can see, there is no mention of a rock in the things that she told the police, nor is there any mention of multiple sexual assaults. So just as with the idea that Rodney Alcala was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list in 1971, just because it's on the internet does not mean that the information you are reading is in fact true, and it's important for you always to go and do your own research if you want to really know what happened in a particular case. Anyways, they end up stopping at a gas station as Alcala needed to use the bathroom. The moment that Alcala goes inside of this bathroom, Monique escapes from the car and runs across the street to a motel called the Monkey Tree, where she pleads with the individual at the reception desk to help her, as the man who was driving the car she was in had raped her. The motel manager agrees to call the police, and as he's in the midst of contacting them, Rodney Alcala runs back out to his car and flees. As she's being questioned by authorities, from the Riverside County Police Department. Monique notices an old flyer hanging on the wall. It is a wanted poster, and on this poster is the picture of Rodney Acala. If you'll recall, this is the wanted poster that the Los Angeles Police Department had asked the FBI to circulate of Rodney Acala after he fled Los Angeles for New York in the late 1960s. The Riverside County PD immediately contact the LAPD, who place Acala under arrest. He's charged with kidnapping, assault, rape, and production of child pornography. And while Acala is under arrest, he's not going to stay incarcerated for long, as he's able to convince his mother that she and his siblings need to raise the $10,000 to bail him out, which they do 2 days later. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you have enjoyed the second look at the dating game killer Rodney Acala. Until next time, stay morbid.